So get this. Until the late 1970s, men's fashion wasn't really a thing. It took a small group of concerted designers, like my guest this week, to push it into the industry it is today. That's why this week on Colby Howard Wants Your Job, it's a retrospective. We speak with Andrew Fezza, a men's fashion wear designer who started in the late 70s and blew up in the 80s and 90s. We go through how you even start a fashion label. What is your first piece? Who do you sell it to? How do you get press? How do you start to handle blowing up? Where do you get this stuff made? All of it is fascinating. Like, share, subscribe. This is Colby Howard Wants Your Job. As always, we're learning together. Let's dive in. Hello, 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 and welcome to Colby Howard Wants Your Job, the podcast where we find out what the heck everyone else does with their day. As always, I'm your host, Colby Howard. Today, we have a very special guest for many reasons. He is my father-in-law. This is high stakes. His name is Andrew Fezza, and he is and was a men's fashion designer overall. Can't wait to talk to him. Andrew Fezza, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Colby. It's great to be here.
Let's go through your accolades.
Well, I think the intro was enough.
Council of Fashion Designers of America Award for Menswear, the Cutty Sark Award for Outstanding Designer, and the Chrysler Cartier Stargazer Award for the Best New American Designer, and the final Cody Award given for menswear.
Yep, you've got it.
There
well,
we
you
go.
Missed one, but I'll let
Which
that
one?
Go.
What was it?
It was several Cutty Sark Awards, I think.
It was more than one.
More than one, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So, first off, you started Andrew Fezza, the eponymous clothing line, in what year?
Officially, I would have to say 1979.
And what was it, considering that era gave us what we know now, Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren, Perry Ellis, like what was happening in that time that all these people are like, you know what I need to do? Menswear.
Yeah. Yeah. Timing is so important in life and everything that you do. And in this case, in my career and the opportunities that were available. So there wasn't really kind of an established menswear industry. I think that was the time that it was really kind of the groundwork was being laid.
What does that mean though? Because like we walk down the street and there's a Bergdorf Men's. Like one side of the street is men's.
Yeah.
Whole stores dedicated to men's. Like what was missing then? There weren't men's stores? Like what does that world look like?
They were emerging. I think the men's clothing was kind of an old men's industry in that it was conservative. It was basically kind of structured around traditional clothing companies. And there were a handful of them that kind of had the market, but it was, you know, tailored. There wasn't really this introduction to sportswear yet. That's kind of what happened at the time. Men became interested in fashion all of a sudden. You had publications that were coming out that were, geared towards menswear. Menswear Magazine, GQ, Esquire. These publications were kind of helping establish an interest and a direction for menswear.
But there was always an adulation of people who would dress nicely, like the Rat Pack are known for their suits. Mm-hmm. And like, so it feels like suiting has always been around. Did this include a revolution in suiting, or was it just other types of clothing that were now surrounding and filling out the wardrobe that men were starting to care about?
I think that there was just a focus that men were more comfortable with fashion. They were more comfortable trying new things, trying new styles, wearing color. They wanted something different. They were looking for alternatives or changes in their wardrobe. Women's fashion changes from season to season, and it goes through, through periods of trends and all of that. Menswear was basically traditional.
Gotcha.
Focused around tradition. And for the first time, you had a generation of men who, took pride in the way they looked and were looking to and interested in presenting themselves. And have a sense of style. So there was an opportunity, and I recognized that. It was, it was timing. I happened to be interested in fashion.
Let's talk about that, because you were at Boston College.
Yeah.
Thinking about being a dentist.
Yes.
Or at least telling your parents you might be a dentist.
I was in a pre-dental program, okay. And this was all, self-motivated.
And so at some point you woke up, had an idea, and the idea germinated enough and blossomed enough that you're like, I'm going to go to the Fashion Institute of Technology. Like, what do you remember how you got the idea and then when you actually got the impulse to make the move?
Definitely, I do. I was, I was at BC, which was, a Jesuit school, and everyone kind of looked the same. And I had one friend who was in the nursing program, believe it or not, and she was from New York. And she just had this incredible sense of style. She looked so different from everybody else. And she would always talk about fashion and her choice to go into nursing versus fashion. Mm-hmm. And had she not gone into nursing, that she would have gone to the Fashion Institute and pursued a career in that. And it just, I think it opened the door for me. I was always interested in fashion as I was growing up and buying clothes for myself. I would always kind of be frustrated with the lack of at retail. I liked something, but I didn't like the color, or I didn't like the fabric, or this would be nice if the collar was different, or if the cut was different. But I didn't know that, this would lead to anything. And I didn't know enough about fashion and, garments and construction and all of that at the time. But in the back of my mind, I always had an interest in the visual aspect of it.
So there's an idea, all of a sudden this friend shows you that there's a way to actually act on these ideas. Like, you can actually go to FIT and do all of this.
She opened a door, and I looked at the people around me at college, and I said, okay, well, I don't have to fit into this mold. Mm-hmm. And I went out and I bought my first Nick shirt. It was called a Nick shirt at the time.
Which was like a Nick shirt.
It was a printed, I think it might have even been polyester shirt.
Very flammable.
And flamboyant. And, a pair of pants that worked with it, and a pair of platform shoes. And I was like, okay, this is happening. Okay. I can do this. Mm-hmm. And, one thing led to the other. And I was like, okay, maybe there is something here. As soon as I got out of school, I said, I'm going to check out fashion school.
So you go down there. Was your first job out of FIT your own line, or was there a stop before?
Oh, many stops.
Oh, there were many stops before.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
So how long was it between FIT and the first inkling of selling something that says Andrew Fezza on it?
I didn't go directly to FIT from undergraduate school. I knew that I wanted to take some time off. And even though I had this idea, I wanted to explore the world a little bit. Mm-hmm. I went to FIT to check out the curriculum, the school, to see if I was even interested in, living in New York and going to school in New York. And, my first visit there, I was just like, wow, it's a whole different world out here. It was just so exciting to be to see the creativity around me. And I took an interview with someone in the admissions office, and I didn't have anything to show them. And she asked for a portfolio, which I eventually put together and submitted, but it had nothing to do with fashion. I mean, I was always interested in art, and I had sketched and drawn in the past. So I just submitted some of that artwork. So I applied to start in the January session, so mid-year. So I had this gap of 4 months, and I said, now's the time for me to get out and see the world. So I got a Eurail pass and I went to Europe. And that kind of opened up the world to me. That's when I was like my first exposure to fashion.
What country in particular?
Primarily in Italy. Just seeing the way people, presented themselves, the way they put themselves together. It just kind of confirmed to me, this is something that I could really enjoy taking to the next level. I got home from my trip, and there was a letter of acceptance. So just, you know, that was it.
When I graduate from college, I have a GPA and I have a major and I try and convince someone to take, to like give me a job off of an interview and 2 points on my resume. When you go out of FIT and someone's hiring you, what are they hiring a new FIT grad? Like, how are you showing that you're good? Do you have a GPA coming out of there? Like, how, what's your grading system?
Well, you know what? I didn't really focus that much. I didn't think about
low GPA.
I don't even know if there was a GPA. I just really wanted to get in and out as quickly as possible.
In and out, but still want the stamp of having gone to FIT.
I didn't even care about the stamp.
Then what were you doing there?
I really just kind of wanted the basic terminology. I wanted kind of the groundwork. You know, I had no idea what textile technology was. I had no idea about draping or pattern making or any of this, fashion illustration. I just wanted kind of a general overview as quickly as possible so that I could get out and work as quickly as possible.
And it got you to New York.
And it got me to New York. However, it was not that easy because I commuted the first, I went into a one-year program because I wanted in and out quickly. And luckily they had it and they accepted me for it because I had an undergraduate degree. I had to commute from New Haven every day. So Jesus. You can imagine. So I didn't have time to follow through with anything that I was really exposed to at FIT. You know, we would get assignments every night and I was always, you know, behind and never finished. And I never really that interested in completing them at the time. But I, you know, I was taking it all in and I understood what had to be done. And it was just, I got to get in here and out of here as quickly as possible.
So you got out with, let's say, not a traditional FIT student's. Some people were competing in FIT to be the best at FIT. You were like, let me get in and out. And so when you're out, how do you think about finding your first job?
Well, while I was there, I couldn't understand why they were all taking it so seriously. First of all, I mean, it was a classroom of maybe 30 people. And coming from this rigorous academic background of organic chemistry, and, you know, botany and zoology and all of these other courses.
This must have seemed like nothing.
This was like, okay, why are these people like, you know, look freaked out over this? Uh-huh. It's like, yeah, you're putting clothes together. Mm-hmm. But now that I look back on it, I understand why they were. They all took it very seriously. Mm-hmm. I learned more at FIT in terms of really kind of putting together garment construction. Mm-hmm. How garments are made. The business part came, you know, that was really all on my own. It came later.
Gotcha.
It was in the field. But I walked out of FIT with kind of just a good knowledge and enough that I could go, you know, and knock on doors and say, okay, I graduated and I'm looking for an assistant position. So that's what I wanted.
And so how many assistant positions did you take before the first Andrew Fezza item? And how many years was that?
I think I only really took one assistant position. I did a little kind of freelance things on the side.
How do you freelance?
You know, I hooked up with a company that wanted a designer to do women's skirts.
And so you would sketch up women's skirts.
I just cranked out sketches for skirts and ideas. And I didn't really even have to follow through with the execution. A few things like that, but that was always on the side. I did not work long before I established my own business, and it overlapped. I really worked for about a year and a half to 2 years as an assistant designer, and that was a great experience. I got the job by basically just going to the two key buildings on 7th Avenue that all of the designer names were in.
Interesting.
And I just went from floor to floor. And I would just drop off my resume with the receptionist.
What was your resume?
It was nothing.
Didn't care about FIT.
Really, it was really nothing. And it was just kind of like an excuse to
the beginning of a conversation.
To start a conversation. Right. And I worked for a company called Schrader Sport. Ended up getting the job, my first job and only job there as an assistant. And my interview the first day, the designer looked at my sketches. He was like not at all interested. He just, I knew that I did not get this job. And I went out on the street 10 minutes after the job, and I was so upset. I said, okay, this job I could really, I know that I could do a good job there. And I wanted it. I wanted anything, because I wanted to move to New York. And I wanted to be able to afford that. So I got to a phone booth, because no one had cell phones at the time. And I called him right back, and I said, I didn't get that job, did I? He said, no, you didn't. I said, would you please let me come back for a second interview? I begged him. And he said, okay. I said, well, what do I have to do to get this second interview? He said, I want you. He said, your portfolio was too uptight. Mm. It made no sense to me at all. He said, I want to see what you can crank out. He said, I want you to do about 50 quick sketches. They're called croquis, which is just a fast sketch to get an overall impression of silhouette, of style, of design. And you know, no one ever told me that at FIT. But this is what he wanted. I said, I'll have it for you in a couple of days. Set up another interview. And I had to kind of talk my way into this position. Mm-hmm. So I got the job.
What was the first item of clothing that you thought about, this is the first thing I want to make as I think about doing my own thing?
I had started doing it while I was there.
What specific, was it a tie? Was it a sport jacket? Was it socks?
I started really kind of designing clothes for myself. I couldn't afford clothes that were in the stores. And I knew what I wanted to look like. And I had access to the sample room. My desk was in the sample room. So I became friendly with the sewers, with the pattern maker. They were my world. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because within the design department of this company, I was the only consistent factor there, because the year and a half that I was there, we went through four different designers.
Including the guy that hired you?
Including the guy that hired me, yeah, who like barely showed up for work every day. And, you know, every day that he came in, he was a different village person. Okay. And he'd stroll in every day around, and I won't mention his name, but he would stroll in every day around 1 or 2 o'clock and probably still hadn't slept from the night before.
Oh, Jesus.
And I was consistent because I knew where everything was.
Right.
And a new designer would come in and they'd say, okay, so what's happening here? What are we doing? What's the format? Who are the suppliers we use? Who do we get our fabrics from? Scheduling for the number of collections that we would do every season or every year, the layout of what those deliveries should look like in terms of sample making. So we knew that we wanted to have 10 blazers, 10 pants, 20 skirts. It was a women's collection. Mm-hmm. So I would feed all that information to the designer. They would put together the line and I would follow through with the execution of the samples and, you know, the purchasing of the fabric and the trims to make sure that we could do everything in a timely manner.
And that became, because it was such a circus and because you needed to learn every, like, there's one thing to be a designer, there's one thing to have your own line.
Yeah.
To have your own line, you need to know how to get fabrics, how to put together a whole.
Exactly. Exactly. And luckily, I mean, I hated sewing myself. Mm-hmm. Because it just was a waste of time for me. It never looked right. And, you know, that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to design it. But pattern making, I kind of enjoyed.
What does that mean?
Pattern making is, how do I take this garment and turn it into a flat pattern? It's the pieces of the garment.
With the people in the back, you're like, hey, can I slip you a 10 and you're going to make me a jacket?
Exactly. That's exactly what I did. I was friends with the pattern maker. I'd say, you know, look it, I want this. Found this great fabric.
Okay, by the way, what do you mean you found this great? Where are you finding these great fabrics?
Okay. So fabric companies would come and show their lines to us for this women's sportswear collection that I was doing. I was in the garment center. So there are fabric stores all over the garment center. So on my free time, I would go in and out of these stores. And if I saw something that I liked for myself, I would just buy the yardage. And
how much? So like, you would buy, I don't know, what, 6 yards? 3 yards. 3 yards, okay.
You know, it depends on what I was making. And yeah, I said I would buy the fabric because I loved it. And eventually I knew I'd make either a shirt or a sweater or something from this.
Got it.
And, you know, I kind of had my own gig in the sample room on the side.
And were you making these for you to wear, or were you making them knowing that eventually there was a line to be made?
No, I was making them for me to wear.
Okay.
Yeah, there were things that I wanted to wear. And I was, because of that, it's like they were, you know, extreme. I wanted things that were different. Mm-hmm. Something
and it
that
was
I,
the 80s? Oh, no, it was the 70s.
It was the late 70s. Yeah, late 70s.
Was extreme kind of the name of the game and the nightlife culture of...
Like it was a revolution happening in menswear. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could wear pretty much anything. I'll never forget those first sweaters that I did. And they were a challenge to construct.
Because of what? What were they different? How were they different than the traditional?
Okay. Typically with a sweater, it's a full fashioned garment like this sweater. Mm-hmm. So this is knitted on a machine and it's actually put together, unlike a woven fabric that is a cut and sew garment. Well, I found a great, incredible, like meshy knit fabric. And I just envisioned these like oversized sweaters out of this, but I didn't have a way to construct them because they couldn't be full fashioned. I didn't have the access to the machinery.
So when you say sewing, like cut and sew, sewing machine that you or I could have at home?
Yes.
Okay.
At this time, I only had access to retail fabrics that I wanted to use, but I wanted a sweater, but I didn't want it to look cheap. I didn't want the seams to look bad. So I said, well, wherever there's a seam, I have to hide it somehow.
Hmm.
So I got this tubing, okay, this filler tubing, and I had them cut the knit around the tubing. So it just ended up looking like this futuristic, it really, really did.
Jetsons. Okay?
It looked like a Jetsons kind of a, and the neckline had to be big enough because it didn't have any stretch to fit over my head, okay? So it was a challenge, but in those challenges, I learned so much, and it forced me to put together something that was so different.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I'm going to go out and I'm going to, because I would wear my clothes,
right,
and people would react to them right away.
Interesting.
They'd say, oh, wow, that's
Where'd
so
you
great.
Get that?
Where did you get that? And I said, you know what? Something's happening here.
Okay.
Let me take advantage of this and see what happens. So with this particular fabric, it had more impact if I made a few of them. So I made 3 or 4 sweaters that were all on this similar type of aesthetic, futuristic and oversized and extreme. They were definitely extreme.
We would call them statement pieces.
It was a real statement piece, yeah. They were real statement pieces. The funny thing is at the time, there were these specialty boutiques popping up all over the city.
Mm-hmm. For menswear.
Interesting. Yeah. And, you know, you would see them covered in the trend section of GQ magazine, the same stores you would see over and over, 2 or 3 stores. I went into the first one of them with the sweaters and they loved them right away.
Hmm.
They said, how quickly can you get them to us?
And how many?
I think initially it was, they wanted like 4 or 5 of each. Mm-hmm. I was like, great, I can do this. And I walked away from the store and I said, oh, now what do I do? Okay. Are they going to have any fabric left over when I go back to this retail store? That's the first challenge. Mm-hmm. Okay. They did. So that was solved. Then I had to find someone to make these sweaters. Okay. Because I really couldn't take it upon myself to do this in my sample room for the company that I worked for.
That was too many.
I didn't want to do that. You know, one sample here and there was one thing. So I had to go out and find factories, or I shouldn't even say at that point they were factories. They were people who sewed on the side. So I'd give
them. How do you find that person?
You know, it was
just in the network.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, you go and you talk to people and you meet people and that's it. You know, I kind of got to know other designers who were doing similar things like that. I met this one guy and his mother sewed. So I was like, okay, great.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to her apartment and I would sit there with her.
Oh my gosh.
And she lived in a studio apartment, believe it or not, over on, I think it was 38th Street. And I would help her, you know, we'd sit there and we'd cut together and she'd put the garment together. And it was great because I got to see what she was doing and I got to control the quality and all of that. But yeah, I, you know, and then when it came time to, you know, deliver the small production that I did it by hand. I didn't know how to ship.
Right.
At the time.
Throw them on your shoulder.
That was it. I just delivered them by hand. Invoice? Oh, I've got to invoice you. Right. Now I need a letterhead. Okay.
And also you need to price them.
And I forget about pricing.
How much was I losing? Yeah. Yeah. Like, what did you charge for her sweater?
Basically, what I did was I kind of like looked at all the other sweaters that they had in their store, and I said, okay, that sounds good. That'll be a good price.
Uh-huh.
And you know, the fabric and labor cost me more.
Oh, amazing. Than,
you know, so there was no markup, but it didn't matter at that point. I just knew what I wanted to do, and to me, that was, you know, that was the start.
So now you're an underground New York City designer who has a few pieces in some boutique stores. Yeah. What's the next level?
The next level was to hit the bigger names.
Bigger names of stores?
Yeah. And actually, no, prior to that, because I was at this one store, I said, oh, this is great entree to the press.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it's somewhere.
Right.
It makes it a lot easier for me to go to GQ and introduce myself and have the samples and get press. So I did that. I got to know people at GQ, got to know people at Esquire, Menswear Magazine, and I would, you know, just go to the offices every week with garment bags filled with clothes, and they loved it. They loved the fact that,
Giving them samples to, like, wear?
Samples to photograph. They had issues coming up, and they had to fill the trend section.
Interesting.
They had to fill. If they were doing a story on, you know, outerwear or whatever, they were looking for new names. They saw that this movement was happening, and they loved the fact that there were young designers coming up with different ideas they could promote through their publications. So
was that world, like, there's probably a ton of designers that were super hot in the early 80s that we've never heard of anymore. Was that a collaborative group and everyone was friends, or was everyone competing? Would you see them all out when you went out at night? Like, what was that world like?
There weren't a lot at the time. There were a handful of menswear designers. I would say in the early 80s, we started to kind of get to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
Some were more established, and, you know, everyone strived to be a known name.
Right.
And the only way we realized to add some traction to our names was to mobilize and form a group and maybe show together.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So we formed this group called the Designers Collective.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first menswear group that collectively had presentation.
When you say presentation, this is a runway show?
No. It was a trade show publication. So we rented out rooms in a hotel midtown. And you would, you know, basically have a room with your wares in it. And it gave the retailers the opportunity to kind of shop in one spot. And we established a week every season. So it was twice a year.
Was that the first men's fashion wear week?
The establishment of, and we got, you know, bigger names to get involved in it when they saw that this was something. So we had a good cross section, East Coast, West Coast designers, because the same thing was happening on the West Coast.
Got it.
They had a whole different vibe.
For sure. And at that point, what was your aesthetic that you became known for, or what was the aesthetic you were going for? Like, what was your style? If people said, oh, like, yeah, I like what Andrew Fezza does, what did that mean at the time?
I think that the style was really kind of established when I started broadening the scope of what I did.
Beyond, from what to what?
Well, as I said, I started with these sweaters that were, you know, funky and easy. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, well, the only way I'm going to be taken seriously is if I try other categories. And I think that the first category that I really kind of blossomed with was leather outerwear. In Italy, I mean, I saw this everywhere. And I said, this is the real thing. And mm-hmm. this is what I want to do. So I put together a collection of, I look at it, I still have some of the samples today, drop dead outerwear. And it was incredible leather textures mm-hmm. and colors and very, very different from like traditional menswear leather jackets.
Do you think that the distinction of the jackets you were putting together was merely the actual leather and how it looked, the patina, or were you also constructing in a certain
way? No, it was the shape. It was the shape that the jackets were in. They were very kind of advanced.
What does that mean?
They were unusual. They weren't, as I said, the typical, leather jacket. Mm-hmm.
And that was intentional.
That was intentional. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was all kind of about the design. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you design anything, it's, a combination of not only fabric and color and texture, it's the cut of the garment. I put together that collection. I presented that to, at the time there was the Women's Wear Daily of the time was a paper called DNR, Daily News Record. And it came out daily at the time. And my leathers got on the cover and I think a 4-page spread.
Wow. Was that your first big break?
First big, big push. The editor just wrote an incredible piece that kind of launched me as a lot more serious in terms of, my capabilities mm-hmm. and the impact that I could have in the menswear industry.
What year was that?
I would say 81.
So you get this spread. How long before you are funding yourself through the clothes you're selling to someone saying, I would like to give you money to make clothes on a broader scale?
It was hand to mouth at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. I mean, eventually it got to the point where I couldn't hold my job anymore.
All right. When did you quit?
Oh, I would say...
When did they fire you?
No, they never did fire me. I really had to walk away. I had to leave the job just because I found that, every day I was taking 2-hour lunches and I was running around to, do my thing mm-hmm. On the side. And I had a friend in Connecticut where mm-hmm. I grew up, a family friend who said to me, if you ever reach the point where you want to take it seriously, mm-hmm. and you're interested in taking on a partner, let me know. So I went to him. I remember I needed $50,000 because I had orders at that point from Barney's and Saks. I'd gone beyond those small specialty yeah. stores. The scope of the collection, actually, I said, okay, I've got to do, tops and bottoms, and I've got to do everything now so that every time I present, every season when I present something, it looks like it's growing. It looks like it's becoming more.
Why does that, and that perception needed to be there so people thought you were big time enough to be, Saks thought you were big time enough to give you an order?
To take a chance on me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They'd come to these shows that we had and they judged you, definitely. Mm-hmm. They wanted to come back and know that they saw something fresh, something new, that they saw a direction, and that they saw expansion and potential. Hmm. And I knew that if I was doing the same thing, if I'd making just sweaters every season, I didn't want to get pigeonholed as the sweater designer. I wanted them to take it seriously as a brand, a designer brand that they could build and know had a lot of depth.
Did you
and potential.
Think, were you ever... Was there ever any doubt or fear that I'm good at sweaters, but like maybe I'm not so good at suits? Like those are not the same pieces of clothing.
No.
So is it natural? Is it fair to say that most designers, if you can design a sweater, you can design a suit, or are they actually more different than you think?
You can't design everything. And I knew mm-hmm. that I never thought of it in terms of having limitations. I just thought of it in terms of when it's the right time mm-hmm. for me to expand into a category that I don't know a lot about. I'll either learn a lot about it before I do it, or I'll get involved with someone who's an expert in that field, which happened probably in the late 80s, early 90s.
Gotcha.
But there was a lot of building that I had to do in terms of every season showing a broader scope of what my talent was and what my ability was. And that meant that I did need that $50,000 to get started. At the time, I was one person doing it all. And I was doing it out of a studio apartment, okay?
Where was the studio apartment?
23rd and 7th.
Ooh.
It was the worst building. I had one of those photographer paper rolls.
The white?
The white one
that
I would pull down so that when I had buyers come, they wouldn't see my bed, right? And I had a desk on the other side of the roll that was the office, and I had a rack of clothes in there. That was my showroom.
That's
was
insane.
The showroom. Yeah, it was my bedroom.
Bedroom, showroom, kitchen. Right.
And they'd walk in, they'd be like, oh. They'd look around.
He's really up and coming.
Yeah, they expected, you know, that I had an office. And I was like, no. I'll never forget one of the editors from Esquire magazine said, you live here? I was like, yes. On the other side of that piece of paper.
Oh, man.
Anyway.
They still like the clothes.
They still like the clothes, yeah. So, I understood what this friend was talking about. And we formed a partnership. He was an entrepreneur, and he had several businesses. And he had access to venture capital. So I said, this is a very smart move, and he'll take care of me and he'll guide me. And he was a friend of the family. So it made sense.
Gotcha.
So one thing led to the other. He invested that money. He hooked me up with, introduced me to a venture capital firm from Canada, who over the period of probably the next 2 years kept putting money in to help me build this business. I couldn't do it out of my studio apartment anymore. I actually had to rent a loft. I had to hire people.
To sew.
I didn't go from the studio apartment to the loft so easily. I went from a studio apartment to a two-bedroom apartment on 15th Street. And I set up a sample room right then and there. And we were actually making small production right there.
Interesting.
And I hired two people to work for me. One fellow was from one of the factories that I had used. And then I hired a friend of my investor who just graduated from college. And she was a friend of mine also. So she did PR. She packed the boxes. She did the shipping. And she was the salesperson. The other guy would wake me up every morning and say, you look like hell. Get out of bed. We're running a business here.
How many hours a day were you working?
Oh, God, kind of nonstop. From the time he'd wake me up every day, feed the cat, put on the coffee.
You had a cat?
I didn't have a cat.
You don't seem like a cat guy.
I'm not a cat guy. There was a cat there, and they used to abuse me because I'd go away for like the weekend and they'd say, you left baby kitty all alone? You're supposed to feed her before you leave. Because when they would show up on Monday, the cat would be like crazy. everybody was doing everything. Everybody was doing a little bit of everything. And I worked long hours, definitely.
And so
it was all about work.
And then so thinking about the shows you put on, the fashion shows that maybe we'll show a clip, maybe not.
Show the clip.
Those were your, at that point, it sounds like, though, you were already in the big stores when you had this. So you were now just part of the fashion cycle of I design, I put on shows, it goes into the store. That was just part of how that world worked.
Yeah. I mean, we were actually one of the first menswear designers that put on a show.
Really?
And I did it prior to, I mean, I wasn't really, you know, I was in certain stores. I was in Saks. I was in Neiman Marcus. I was in stores like that. Mm-hmm. But we put on like a, we would just take our loft and turn it into a fashion show. We had mm-hmm. runways built and, you know, it was great. And that I said, okay, this is a whole different thing. If we can do this and continue to do this, then it really will establish us in that world. And then, yes, then the fashion shows became a lot more elaborate,
yeah.
you know, in the late 80s and the 90s. Yes, very, very elaborate.
There how were much,
major productions.
I mean, how did you have a hand in every bit of that design? Because it was your brand's aesthetic, like everything that we see on those videos, you said, yeah. I want that, I want that, I want the models to do that, I want the models to look like this. I mean, you found the models.
We did it all. We worked with a fella who's very, very talented. He worked at our ad agency,
mm-hmm.
and he came to work for us, a guy named Trey Laird, and he's phenomenal at everything that he does. He put together those shows, and he had a vision for everything, and we worked closely with him on the execution of those. To put on a production like that,
yeah.
I mean, to put together the collection at that scale, it's you know, it's a major task. But then when you're going to present it, you have to go above and beyond, because maybe 30, 40% of what you're presenting, you have no intention of ever producing, but you know, to put on a show to that scale, it's got to be drop dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it means going that extra, you know, gotcha. That extra mile to make it look like that. So it requires a lot more sample making, a lot more attention to detail. It's a lot different than, you know, hanging a garment in the showroom and showing the collection.
Got it.
You know, it's a whole aesthetic. Mm-hmm. It's you're setting a mood, a tone, a world. You're creating a world for someone to immerse themselves in and understand the vision. And it was really, really an exciting thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way of presenting. We didn't always do it in a runway form. We did it in still life sometime. But it was always sometimes we hired architectural firms, believe it or not, to do it for us, to put on these vignettes. So yeah, it was all very, very exciting.
And then finally, Liam Neeson, obviously those beautiful pictures, and John Malkovich in your sweaters. How did you link up with them?
We decided that we wanted to use celebrities in ad campaigns, mm-hmm. but, you know, celebrities that were just kind of just becoming established. I mean, Liam Neeson was pretty established, but the timing was good. It was like he was prior to Schindler's List. We used initially, I think the first one we used was Michael Ancine,
mm-hmm.
Who was in this series on TV at the time called Twin Peaks.
Got it.
These are people that I, you know, Trey and I would discuss it. Who do we think would be good? Trey, mm-hmm. I, and Marilyn would discuss it, because Marilyn did all the marketing at the time. And
Marilyn's his wife, my mother-in-law.
So yeah, Liam Neeson, John Malkovich,
mm-hmm.
great yeah, choice. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was always crazy about John Malkovich, and I said, I'd love to see him in my clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for two of those campaigns, we used Herb Ritts.
Mm-hmm.
He's an incredible photographer. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful images. The
very cool
marketing is like a big thing, and mm-hmm. we became very much involved and interested in it, and it was all part of the total package.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much.
This
was awesome.
This was a lot of fun.
I hope all of you learned how to create a fashion brand in the 1980s. And I wonder how much of that is relevant. Probably not much to today. Well, like the hustle, living, breathing, doing whatever you can, making a showroom in your studio apartment, that all probably still applies.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's all about being passionate about what you're doing and how to do it. And sometimes, you know, not knowing what you're doing is even better.
Yeah.
Because you make mistakes and you learn from them. And
you do something new.
You do something new. Yeah.
Well, this has been Colby Howard Wants Your Job. Thank you for tuning in.
I want Colby Howard's job.
Interrogating other people. Tune in next week for the next job. Thanks for listening. Talk soon.